time. Welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's back with you on this Thursday on WYPR. Thanks again for joining us as we continue our candidates week here. The Maryland gubernatorial primary, less than a week away. It's next Tuesday, June 24th. Early voting, of course, already started and continuing through this evening. There are four Republican candidates for governor, three Democrats vying for the state's top job for the nomination of their party. So at Midday, we've devoted the whole week to this. We've been interviewing all the candidates. We'll have a couple more on the show today and a couple more tomorrow. Tomorrow, Douglas Gansler will be with us, Democratic candidate for governor, and David Craig, Republican candidate for governor, joining us on the Friday show. In the second hour of today's show, GOP candidate Larry Hogan will be with us for the full hour to answer my questions and yours. And here with us for this hour of Midday is Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, Anthony Brown, who is one of the candidates for governor in Tuesday's election. Lieutenant Governor, nice to see you again.
Dan, it's great to be on.
You were on the show last September for the first time to talk about your candidacy. Here's my question I've been asking all the candidates this week. Because you've been going out to lots of debates, candidates' forums, shaking hands with people. And I wonder if you could tell us what's on the minds of voters. What have you been hearing from people when you ask them what their concerns are, or they volunteer them, because we know people like to volunteer.
Oh, yeah.
They see an elected official, and they like to tell you what's on their mind. Well, what would you say has been a recurring theme, if any, among people that you've met on the campaign trail?
You know, the two issues that come up the most, and there are, you know, these are not one-dimensional issues, but it falls in the category of jobs, mm-hmm. and education, and often the intersection of the two. I may get have someone come up to me and say, hey, I just lost my job, and I'm looking to, you know, move into a different field. And their concern, their interest is, you know, what type of skills training is there for, you know, an incumbent worker or a displaced worker. So there's that intersection of education and jobs. But it often, those are the two areas. You know, what are we doing to grow the economy, create jobs? I think most Marylanders recognize that jobs are created by private sector employers, but they understand that there are things that we do in the public sector to create the conditions that encourage that support private sector job growth. So people ask me about that. What's your plan? And then on the education piece, again, there's a whole lot to it, depending on whether I've got a parent with a very young one, and then they're thinking about early childhood education. I've got parents with kids in high school, and they may be, you know, more interested in, you know, what are we doing to boost the graduation rates, although pre-K does that, but they're thinking more about career technology education and what are we doing with or for or to support those students that aren't going to the four-year college right after high school. What plans do you have? So it really falls into jobs and education. And that's why if you look at the 16 policy proposals on our campaign, you know, a full one-third of them deal with education. We have a five-part jobs plan. We have a business climate framework. These are the issues that folks are talking about. These are the big issues of the day.
On jobs, do you sense that people have a sense that the future is not clear, that we're not creating, not only creating jobs, not creating good jobs in the United States. They're worried still in general about the economy, even though we're told that the economy is kicking back. To the average person and consumer, maybe it doesn't seem that way.
Yeah, I think that as a result of this recession, it is sort of reset or adjusted people's outlook about job security, financial security, the ability to save for college, save for retirement, the security in my home, not necessarily the physical security, but the financial security of owning and holding onto that home. So I think you have that. Now we're in this, I guess maybe even technically, we may even be beyond the recovery, but this has been a protracted recovery, post-recession recovery, very long, very protracted, very slow. We're seeing that certainly in public sector budgets, the growth in our budget, we are growing, but not at the rates that we see during normal growth periods. We're creating jobs in Maryland. Some of them are in, you know, high-tech, high-paying fields like cybersecurity, and some of them are in retail, which are not as high-paying. So we do have a broad range of job growth. But to answer your question, I think there is, and while I spend my time in Maryland, I don't think this is a unique experience in Maryland, but there is a heightened sense of insecurity because of what we've just come through.
There's a portrait of Maryland that's been painted by the Republican candidates for governor, and I've heard it, our listeners have heard it this week on this show, and we've heard it repeatedly, that basically it goes like this, and I'm quoting here a Washington Post summary of this. Maryland has been laid low by the Democratic establishment in Annapolis, which in 8 years under Governor Martin O'Malley has taxed the life out of the state's economy, leaving Virginia to claim the spoils. That's sort of the way things are portrayed here, that we've been the state has been taxed to death and the economy is flat.
Look, there's
as a result of that.
Right. Look, there's a lot of and I'll come back to the economy in a second, but you know, there are a lot of great things going on in Maryland. We've built, you know, some of the best in the nation public schools, and you know, sure, not every child at this point, and this is where we have work to do. Is in a blue ribbon school. Our work continues until every child has access to a world-class education, starts with early childhood education, expanding that. That's why I've got a plan for pre-K. It's more than a plan. We've started that expansion this year in the General Assembly. Maryland is a safer state than it was, you know, certainly 30 years ago and even 8 years ago. And the good thing is that not only have we driven crime down to levels we haven't seen in 3 decades, but our inmate population is smaller. Recidivism, we're driving that down. It was closer to 50%. Now it's closer to 40%. But we have more work to do because there are some states that have recidivism rates in the mid-20s. Mm-hmm. So no, you know, I certainly, when I talk about the progress that we're making in Maryland, I don't put a period after that progress point. It's a comma or a semicolon, and we address what we need to do to build on that success. In terms of Virginia versus Maryland on the economy, there are a lot of different, you know, economic data sets that you can use to support, you know, either side of the argument. You know, Maryland's stronger than Virginia. Let me show you why. Virginia is stronger than Maryland. Let me show you why. You know, when people ask me, and we go back to the first question, you know, what's on people's minds? It's jobs and the economy. So let's talk about jobs. In the last 12 months in Maryland, the private sector created close to 25,000 jobs. I should say it a different way. We created close to 25,000 jobs, the vast majority in the private sector. During that same 12-month period, Virginia lost 5,000 jobs. So if we were doing a comparison based on just job growth in the last 12 months, I'd say, look, Maryland's doing well. But don't get me wrong. I'm not celebrating job loss in Virginia. If Maryland is going to do well, we want Virginia to have a strong economy. We want Maryland to have a strong economy, as we do for Pennsylvania, Delaware, and the district. We want a strong regional economy that boosts Maryland's economy and employment. So a lot of, you know, Maryland's made a lot of progress. A lot of good things are going on. We've got to be very candid and honest about where we're coming up short. And then we'll build on that. We'll make improvements there.
What do you say when you hear the criticism that the taxes are generally too high and there are too many taxes in fees? And if we just eliminated some taxes, like some candidates are calling for a phased out elimination of the personal income tax in Maryland altogether, if we just did that, the private sector would grow. There wouldn't be such a great reliance on the federal government for jobs in Maryland.
So when you have an increase in cost to both individuals in their homes, right, their personal spending, and to businesses, and whether that's because gas prices are going up because, you know, the cost per barrel of oil is going up, or if that's because the person that's coming in and doing a plumbing repair in your house charges you more this year than they did last year. It's hard to convince people that that they're paying the right amount of taxes, and so it's appealing when some, particularly on a campaign trail, you know, say, hey, you're paying too much in taxes. So what Ken Ullman and I have committed to doing is in the first year of the Brown-Ullman administration, we are going to undertake the very difficult work of comprehensive tax reform. And the first question that we need to ask is looking at the comparables, states that are comparable to Maryland, same quality of life, the same types of schools in terms of the quality of education, the outcomes, the same level of uninsured in terms of in the healthcare market. You look at the comparables, you include your neighbor states, and certainly Virginia would need to be in that. And you look at the overall revenues per capita, and you say, hey, how do we stand? Are we asking Marylanders to give more, less, or roughly the same? And I think that's a an important threshold question. And then when we go to the next set of questions, which is how can we reform? Let's reform our tax code. And in a Brown-Ullman administration, we'll be guided by three principles. One is let's find ways to provide relief to working families. Okay. Number two, let's find ways to incentivize employers, whether that's tax credits, tax deductions, or exemptions. Look at our tax code and how can we incentivize employers to invest in their businesses in Maryland? Because when they do that, they create jobs. And then number three, though, and this is important, and it's all related, particularly to that first question, how much are we asking of Marylanders? We don't want to roll back our investments. We've made college more affordable. We don't want to roll that back. You know, we've made investments in education, and the numbers there, the progress points there are just off the charts in terms of the progress that our kids are making in school. We don't want to roll that back either. Public safety, public health, the environment. So protecting the investments that we've made. So Ken and I are going to do that. Some people will say, well, you're just kicking the can down the road. Comprehensive tax reform is not something that you do on a campaign trail. Some candidates on the campaign trail, depending on the audience they're talking to, they say, oh, we're going to reduce that tax. Mm-hmm. And then they're talking to another audience. They say, oh, we're going to reduce that
tax. Or eliminate it.
Or eliminate it, right. Because everyone can find a tax that they don't like. But we want to take a much more methodical, comprehensive approach to tax reform.
Anthony Brown is our guest in this hour of midday, the Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, a candidate in the Democratic primary for governor. His running mate, he's alluded to, Ken Ullman, is the Howard County Executive. You can join us in this hour with a question for Lieutenant Governor Brown, 410-662-8780. That's the number for midday. The email address is midday@wypr.org. I have some questions already for Lieutenant Governor Brown by email to read for him when we get back. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown is our guest in this hour of the show. As I said, you're welcome to call us at 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. A comment by Frank in Hampstead on taxes and jobs. He says, the job creators are the consumer worker. They create the demand. Businesses only expand when there is a demand. No demand, no expansion. That's business 101. Taxes are the price that must be paid for civilization. The taxes businesses pay for the roads that enable customers to come and buy and also to deliver the things businesses make or sell. Let us be fair. Business have to pay their fair share of taxes as well as consumers and workers. Let's see. There's another question in here for you, Lieutenant Governor, but I'll get to that in a minute.
Can I comment on that one? That was Frank. Look, I think Frank has a valid point. I mean, I'm not an economist, but in speaking with business leaders, I understand a number of things. One is that there are businesses in Maryland, and you can take, for example, cybersecurity. Right? There's a growing demand for cybersecurity services, not just in the public sector. You know, defending, you know, the Defense Department and things like that, but also in the private sector, defending, universities,
retailers, and their credit cards,
right? Retailers,
their customers' credit cards,
absolutely. Yeah. And and so there is a demand. But what businesses often need is access to capital, particularly these small businesses in Maryland that are the innovators, and they need access to capital. With greater access to capital, they can invest in their businesses, create the jobs to meet the already existing unmet demand. But Frank is also right in that the consumer, right? So that's why we raised the minimum wage. One of the reasons, okay, one is we thought it was fair to give, you know, a half a million Marylanders a raise by going from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour. But also studies showed that with that increased wage from $7.25 to $10.10, we're going to boost or infuse into the economy through consumer demand about $500 million, creating several thousand jobs.
What did you think of the phase-in of the minimum wage, 4 years, a 4 year phase in.
I thought it was too slow. I mean, look, the governor and I, our proposal was much shorter than that.
Okay. I noticed that you disagreed. It turns out that you disagreed with the governor on the ceiling for the estate tax in Maryland. In Maryland, it was raised from $1 million to, I forget now.
Yeah, I think $5 million.
$5 million over the next 4 years.
Recoupled with the Fed, right.
Yeah, and a lot of us, including me, saw that as just a giveaway to millionaires in Maryland. And it turns out that you didn't support that idea.
Yeah, let me clarify when you say the disagree.
The taxable ceiling.
Right, and I'm not defending the governor, okay? But let me explain that that estate tax revision was not a Governor O'Malley initiative.
No, I know
proposal.
That.
Right.
But he signed it.
Right, that's right. So what I have said, I said it contemporaneous to the action happening in the legislature, and then I said it again on the Baltimore debate. During the Baltimore debate on MPT and WBAL, I would have worked with the presiding officers and prevailed upon them. Don't send me an estate tax reform or revision provision. Don't send me that. That's piecemeal tax reform. We're going to undergo comprehensive tax reform. Even when we, in 2007, when we changed our tax code, when we did it again in 2012, we tried to be as comprehensive and progressive as possible. So when the legislature sent to the governor the estate tax provisions, which benefited a handful of Maryland families, my comment at the time was this is piecemeal because it will be a significant reduction in revenues to the state. I would prefer, and as governor, my approach will be to do this in the context of my budget. So if I'm offering tax reductions, you know, whether it's income or sales or property, I'm going to show you how it impacts my expenditures.
You wanted to see it as part of a big package. What did you think about it on its own? Were you convinced that Maryland needed to do this to keep millionaires from retiring to Florida?
I'm not convinced that that's the case.
That was sort of basically the argument, right?
Right. I understand the argument. I'm not convinced. And with each tax reduction, you've got to look at the costs and benefits.
I wanted to go over the health benefit exchange issues with you here today, Lieutenant Governor Brown, because, you know, this has been a big issue with you. I've raised it. Other people have raised it. Your opponents certainly have brought it up. At least Doug Gansler has brought it up a number of times about your role in the rollout of the Maryland's health insurance exchange. And Republicans now are throwing out numbers about the cost of the repair. First, the initial cost of getting this website up and running, our online marketplace for insurance, which was glitch-filled. It crashed on the day it launched. And then there's the cost of the recovery and the transition to a new system for the coming year. I understand the new system was supposed to be tested even this week or late last week. And we're having another enrollment period that starts up in mid-November.
Yeah, mid-November.
I think, right? Okay, so let's just go over this. What is the cost of the recovery? What has been done in terms of the recovery? What is it going to cost?
Good. First of all, let's frame up what we're talking about here, because sometimes as I'm talking to Marylanders, there's this misperception or understanding that. That the cost is just a website. So you've got this health benefits exchange, which is a system. It's a system that's comprised of men and women who are making decisions and determinations and evaluations that are reviewing products, you know, the insurance products and things like that. And then there's a website that is one of the tools, one of the ways in which Marylanders access the services, which are the health plans through the health benefits exchange. When you hear about that larger number of the costs, that's for the entire exchange, not just the website. So that the reason why that's important is because, yes, Maryland had a troubled launch, as did the federal government. President Obama was faced with a technical challenge on his launch. Every state, for the most part, the only ones that seem to do better than others are Kentucky and Connecticut, and the common denominator there, they had Deloitte Consulting. And
they had Deloitte Consulting set up their system.
Right. And so right now, Maryland is in the process of adopting the Connecticut technology. We are working very closely with the federal government, CMS, Center for Medicaid, Medicare Services. We have used the same consultant firm that the federal government used to actually get theirs right. And that consultant firm who helped the federal government, you know, fix their challenges, they recommended to Maryland, don't go with the federal government. Go with Connecticut.
Don't use the Fed's website.
Yeah, don't use the Fed website. And a lot of that comes back to Medicaid. And what I mean by that is, you know, we've got about 1 million Medicaid subscribers in Maryland, and we have to continue to service them when they have change in life events and eligibility determinations and things like that. If we go to the federal website doesn't have the same Medicaid capabilities, so that would set us back in terms of the Medicaid population. We go to Connecticut, we can stay with our Medicaid system, we can improve the Medicaid system without any delays, and we can go with known technology. Now, we have proposed to the federal government the way to fund this, the way to pay for this, and we have not announced yet what that funding arrangement will be. So I don't want to share it with you, but we're working out a funding arrangement that I think, you know, once we share that, it will be acceptable to the public. Will it cost us a little bit more for the technical problems? Yes, it costs the federal government more. It costs all of the states a little bit more. And that was the cost of delivering a large technology platform.
Well, in late May, the Maryland Health Benefit Exchange Board voted some contracts, authorized a couple of contracts with technology firms totaling $43.5 million for this transition. That involves Deloitte, a contract with Deloitte of 3 years, and a 5-year contract with Xerox Corporation. So now, can we say that this cost would not have been incurred had our original exchange website functioned properly?
Yeah, there's certainly portions.
So this is part of it.
Yeah, that's right. There are portions that wouldn't be incurred. I think the cost of inaction would be greater. I mean, if we decided that we were not going to make those types of expenditures, the cost to Marylanders, you saw recently, I don't know, maybe as 4 weeks ago, that the level of uncompensated care in our hospitals has gone down dramatically because of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, because of the number of people enrolled through the Health Benefits Exchange. So that helps keep costs down in hospitals. It helps keeps our insurance rates down for those of us that have commercial plans, and also as taxpayers because we pay for Medicaid. So there are savings that are going to be achieved with the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act.
Okay. I've heard numbers as high as $300 million as an estimate of what this will end up costing the state of Maryland. And I don't see any math that brings us to that number. Plus, isn't there also the possibility of getting some money back from the original contractors on this?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've said this all along, that we preserve all of our legal rights and remedies against contractors. This isn't unique to the Health Benefits Exchange. Anytime that we contract, large or small, with vendors that don't deliver as they promise, and that certainly is the case here, with a number of vendors with whom we contracted, we reserve our legal remedies, and we will take them, to court if necessary. If we can't reach an agreement short of court, but that's what we do whenever we have a procurement go bad like this one did.
And Lieutenant Governor, one of your opponents in the primary election has called this an unmitigated disaster, Maryland's Health Benefit Exchange. I call it a mitigated disaster, whereas maybe the rollout was pretty bad. It crashed. The state recovered somehow and got some 343,000 people signed up for new or improved insurance during that period between October and April sometime, right? So looking back on it all, I mean, because you've been beat up on this a good bit, what would you say about this experience and your role in it last year?
Well, what I would say is that, you know, if you look at what we set out to do when we were implementing the Affordable Care Act, it was to enroll as many Marylanders as we could. Now, our goal was 260,000. And when the website failed, we reorganized the leadership, right? We refocused the vendors, got rid of some of them, and we plussed up resources for this system, the Health Benefits Exchange, which, as I said, is more than a website. More people at call centers, more navigators around the state. And as a result, not only did we hit our goal, but, you know, we hit 340,000 Marylanders. You know, these are real people. These are families who were priced out of the market because a family member had a pre-existing condition, and today they can get a much more affordable product, and there are stories abound, you know, like that. Seniors who are not making the choice between groceries and prescription drugs, and there are a lot of examples of that. So, you know, what we did is when the technology didn't serve us, you know, we did it the old-fashioned way, a lot of manual workarounds. Where people were literally rolling up their sleeves and figuring, you know, taking out a calculator and making the determinations and the decisions. So with the adoption of the Connecticut technology, as we go to this next open enrollment in November, not only will we set out to meet or exceed our goal of the number enrolled, but it'll be a much more seamless user experience as the website using the Connecticut technology is much improved.
We hope. You have confidence.
Well, it's proven technology. It worked in Connecticut.
It worked in Connecticut. Yeah. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. If you have a question for Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, candidate for governor in Maryland's primary, which is next Tuesday, June 24th. A comment by email from Kevin regarding people leaving the state of Maryland. He says, there's always people moving from one state to another for varying reasons. And there will always be malcontents. If one state doesn't have income tax or sales taxes, they'll have fees. Is the grass really always greener on the other side? Thank you for your comments. Questions also. Here's a question for you, Lieutenant Governor, from Jen in Lauraville. What have you done and what will you do to ensure Maryland transitions to clean energy to combat climate change?
Sure. Was that Jen?
Jen.
Jen. And so, look, Maryland has, and we have accepted that we have a responsibility, a role in addressing climate change. And some of the things that that we are focusing on, and in a Brown-Ullman administration, we will continue this effort, is in renewable energy. You know, we passed a framework for offshore wind. Unfortunately, that's not moving forward right now. We have yet to sort of attract a developer. We've increased the land-based wind farms in Maryland with a project going forward, a new one on the Eastern Shore. That was the subject of a lot of controversy this past legislative session. So certainly renewables. We created a carve-out for solar energy in our, as part of the renewable portfolio standards. As a result, we're generating more solar energy in Maryland, creating several thousand jobs to go along with it. So I think renewable energy generation is important, and not only for climate change, it's important for creating jobs in Maryland, and it's important for us to begin seeing much more affordable and reliable energy in Maryland. We import more energy for both residential and commercial users here in Maryland than our surrounding states. That adds to the cost, and it impacts the reliability of that energy. So renewable is a big way. The other component is to continue increase energy efficiency, right? And whether that's in our homes, energy efficient appliances, and looking for opportunities to provide tax credits for homeowners to do the kinds of upgrades, but also in commercial and industrial uses as well. I was talking with a light manufacturer the other day, and we were talking about taxes and regulations and various costs. And this particular business owner said, look, whether you're reducing my taxes by a few percentage points or whether I'm reducing the cost of energy or my energy consumption by a few percentage points, a reduction is a reduction, and that's what I'm looking for. So we need to look at ways as a state to incentivize commercial and industrial users as well to achieve greater energy efficiency in their operations. That's going to be good for, you know, addressing our responsibility, our role in climate change.
I had a question for you on the environmental front in terms of water quality in the Chesapeake Bay and as it affects life in the Bay. You know, the reports about rockfish and crabs in the Bay, not good this year. Water quality, not good. The Baltimore Harbor getting a failing grade, even from the organization that's overseeing, trying to oversee its renaissance. Have you thought about taking a newer or fresh approach with other governors, if you were elected, other governors in the Chesapeake watershed about really doing something to try to improve water quality in the Bay?
And it has to be a regional approach. I mean, I think about...
We've had one for many years.
Right.
I mean, but have you thought about it, maybe taking a fresh approach to it?
I think, you know, I think a regional approach that is coupled with a strong partner in the federal government. We have to find ways to incentivize our neighboring states, particularly when I think about some of our upstream states like Pennsylvania and New York, to reduce the runoff that eventually ends up in the Susquehanna and ends up in the Chesapeake. And as we're looking at the Conowingo Dam and Exelon extending the permit for that, we know that the buildup behind the Conowingo Dam is not did not all of it didn't originate in Maryland. So that's just a classic example of how you have to have a regional approach. I think looking at incentives. Now, you know, Maryland, I mean, it would be hard pressed to provide Maryland incentives for New York and Pennsylvania to reduce the runoff and the erosion that creates that. But partnering with the federal government, I mean, that's a thought, that's an idea. But I do agree with the premise of the question that we've got to find new and innovative ways to partner.
Here's a question for you from Waverly in Baltimore along these lines. Dan, go right ahead. You're on with Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown.
Yeah, hi, Anthony Brown. I have a small business. We employ eight to ten employees, and we are impacted by the rain tax. We have a warehouse of like 9,000 square feet, and our rain tax is $330 each quarter. And I think that I was wondering if it just to me seems like the businesses in Maryland are affected disproportionately to anybody else, and then there's very small businesses that are next to me that they rent out this warehouse and they have to worry about the rent, and then there's landlords that their tenants pay for this, and that increases the rent for businesses and also for renters that are actually, you know, it seems to me the government wants to foster cheap housing, but yet they seem to turn around and tax all that they're trying to foster.
Hey, Dan, excuse me, let me ask you something. Can you go back to the beginning of your question? How large is the property you're talking about?
About 9,000 square feet is a footprint.
And the city charges you for the stormwater fee $330 per quarter?
Yes.
Okay. And you think that's too high?
I think that the government wants to, Anthony Brown and other candidates want to foster businesses. And I think this is an example of how they tax businesses. And the more you tax something, the less you're going to get of it.
So let's talk about that stormwater facility management fee, because that's what it is. And so this is the origins is that it's an EPA requirement, which I embrace. It's a requirement that's intended to restore the health of the Chesapeake Bay, reducing stormwater runoff into the bay. And you'll recall, Dan, that I believe it was 2 years ago, state government worked with local government, counties and the city came to Annapolis and said, give us the authority to manage this program. We don't want a uniform statewide program because each jurisdiction wanted to do it differently. In Prince George's County, for example, they've entered into public-private partnerships with a company that is going to renovate, upgrade the 43,000 stormwater facilities in Prince George's County, private dollar investments. Now, you know, ratepayers and property owners will repay it, but over a much a longer period of time so that the impact will be less per quarter. You said you're paying about $330 a quarter. So I don't know if you did the public private partnership. I don't know what that would look like for you, but conceptually it would be less. So what we've done is we've let each of the counties and the city determine their own way of financing it, and the goal is that each county in the city will look at best practices in other counties and say, hey, that works. It's not as burdensome on property owners. So let's look at doing it that way. Some counties are working particularly with the nonprofit community that also has raised the issue of the impact on nonprofit.
Do you understand
nonprofit.
The merit of this? You say you embrace the EPA requirement.
Yeah,
do something about stormwater runoff.
Absolutely, I mean, because
how do you convince a businessman that he's got a bill for another $1,300 a year, another $1,300 expense on his business, that this is good for him, good for his business, good for his city?
It's good for Maryland because the health of the Chesapeake Bay is important. It provides a livelihood to tens of thousands of employees. It's the source of a number of very important, not the source, it provides a resource for very important industries in Maryland, tourism, agriculture. They create jobs, they create revenues that support schools and public safety measures and infrastructure investments. As I speak with business owners, what they say to me is, we understand the need to protect the Chesapeake. We want to be able to do that by complying with regulations in a cost-effective way. So we've got this regulation to upgrade our stormwater management facilities. We need to do that to protect the Chesapeake Bay. We've got to look for the most creative, innovative ways to finance those upgrades. And again, I point to Prince George's County. They've done a really good job.
Anthony Brown, Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, is our guest in this hour of Midday. Midday Candidates Conversations continue after this break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Another question for Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown. Trevor in Cockeysville, back to the subject of education. Trevor, thanks for calling.
Hi. I was just wondering, I know you have a proposal for universal pre-K, and I was wondering how you're planning on afford it in terms of paying for it and how it's different from the other candidates' policies.
Sure, Trevor. My proposal for expanding pre-K would be to go to universal half-day pre-K by 2018. So that would be for all Maryland four-year-olds would have access, regardless of means, to half-day pre-K. And then when we go by 2022, I would expand it to universal full-day pre-K, much like what we have today for kindergarten. So on that first phase, the 2018, that would be about a 2% increase in our education budget. And if you look at anthonybrown.com, I've got a fairly comprehensive proposal on how we implement it and how we pay for it. We can pay for that universal half day, that 2% increase, with the revenues from expanded gaming, including, Maryland Live and what's being developed at MGM. We did include a provision in the law when we expanded gaming to fund pre-K education. When we go to the full day, that is going to cost more, and it's going to rely on a traditional funding relationship between state and local government. Right now, we have funded an adequacy study for education, which just started this year, and it's going to complete its work next year. That's that Thornton II Bridge to Excellence. And as part of that, we're asking the study group to study and come back with recommendations to fund that universal full day. It's an investment that is certainly worthwhile. We know that kids that start kindergarten ready to learn, their educational outcomes are greatly improved. Their ability to get, better jobs increases. In fact, if you ask most college presidents what are some of the things that we can do to improve college readiness and college completion, they'll point to a number of things on their campus, but they'll also point to universal pre-K. So it's an investment worth making.
A question by email from Catherine in Frederick. What is your position on fracking for natural gas and the Cove Point natural gas project?
So I I believe that the natural gas in the Marcellus Shale may present a economically enticing opportunity, but I would not support moving forward on fracking unless we have assurances that it will not do harm to the environment. It won't disrupt the rural legacy and nature characteristics of Western Maryland, and it won't put Marylanders who work in that industry at risk. That's why I supported the study, which will be completed this summer. It's going to look at those issues and more. And so if it's something that we can do in a safe way, both the environment and the people, good. If not, then not good.
The Cove Point question has to do with the transportation of more gas to that place in Maryland and shipping it from there.
Right. So your next governor, and, you know, I hope to serve in that role, is going to have in front of them both an approval from FERC as well as the Public Service Commission.
Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Thank you.
Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the Public Service Commission, the PSC. In both of those approvals, and each one of them, the approvals are different, but in each one of those, there are rather extensive environmental conditions that have to be met before the project can go forward. I think the PSC had 138 conditions on that approval. Many of them deal with air and water quality. So as your next governor, I will rigorously and vigorously ensure that those conditions are met and hold the Dominion or whoever ends up delivering that to those high standards.
Here's an email question from Shashi. Shashi wants to know or says that I'm very troubled about Lieutenant Governor Brown's plan to give business incentives because there is no mechanism to account for their efficacy. We already have more than 30 tax breaks and nobody seems to monitor if they make sense. How would your administration know that a particular incentive has run out of its usefulness?
And, you know, that's the question that we need to be asking about really everything that we do in government, right? Because we create a program, a service, an incentive, a credit today, and then is it still relevant and meaningful 5 years from now, 10 years from now? But I do believe in principle that there are incentives and credits that we can provide to businesses that where the benefit to Maryland will outweigh the cost of that credit. I'm going to give you one example. And while it's healthcare, it's business because healthcare is a business. We have communities in Maryland that have higher incidences of chronic illnesses and diseases. Okay, health disparities that exist in communities throughout Maryland, and one of the determinants is the lack of wellness and prevention services, primary care. So I created something called the Health Enterprise Zones, where we provide credits, tax credits, to healthcare providers. They're business people, but they're also healthcare providers. Provide tax credits to go into those communities to deliver greater services. So somebody could look at that and say, well, why are you giving money to businesses to do something to provide a business in a community that needs the business? Well, because they're not going into those communities. But now with a tax credit, they're going into those communities, but the benefit to Maryland far outweighs the tax credit we're giving them.
Because, have we seen any yet?
So the program has been in place now for 1 year. We have metrics that are going to measure the progress, right?
Mm-hmm.
Looking at things like emergency department visits, looking at the incidence of the particular chronic disease that we're trying to reduce in that zone. Every zone is a little bit different. So we have metrics to measure the progress, and it's in its infancy. It's only about a year. This program's about a year old. But because I'm mindful of the question, you know, why are we doing this? Are we measuring it? Are we ensuring that they work? We have metrics that are established so that we can. I believe that what we'll find in less than a year using this metric, because in less than a year we'll be about 2 years into it, that, wow, we are seeing emergency department reductions. We are seeing reductions in, you know, childhood asthma in that zone, if that was one of the conditions they were addressing. So it's saving, it's not only improving the health of people in that community, but it's saving all of us money.
Thurman up in Harford County has a question for Lieutenant Governor Brown. Thurman, go right ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rodericks, and thank you, Lieutenant Governor. I really enjoy your show and appreciate you coming on. I wanted to ask about, I believe you have to help me, $300 million that was taken from the teachers' retirement fund and was due to be funded again this year. It didn't happen. Really like Senator James, but she said she wouldn't vote for it, and she's true to her word, she didn't. But I wonder if you had any plans for putting that money back, and I may have the number wrong. I'm sorry.
It's at least $200 million.
Yeah,
we know that.
That's right.
And the governor said he would and didn't, and go ahead.
So, Thurman, so it is $200 million, and that is a lot of money. And, you know, we are beyond the recession. The recovery is behind us. We are now returning to the new normal, which may not be as fast of a growth as we've seen in you know, previous decades. But I don't believe, and I think Thurman, you and I agree on this, that we should be looking to the state employee pension to pay for current obligations to fund our current operating budget. When that was approved this year, there part of that approval was a plan to repay that $200 million. And as governor, I will ensure that that happens according to the plan. But also as governor, you can count on me not to look to the pension system to fund our ongoing obligations.
I asked you this question because it was in the news yesterday and today, and this has to do with the U.S. Patent and Trademarks Office canceling the trademark registration of the National Football League team in Washington that plays in Landover, Maryland, practices and plays in Landover, that football team. I don't use that football team's name, and that's what this controversy is about and has been about for some time. And have you made up your mind about this? Have you registered your feelings about the name of that football team?
Yeah, in fact, during the first televised debate, I said that I no longer refer to the Washington football team by their nickname. I do believe it's offensive. So when I read yesterday or the day before that the Patent and Trademark Office canceled it, I supported that. I was pleased with that decision, and I do think that over time. That Washington will adopt a new nickname. Don't know whether it'll happen under the current owner or not, but I certainly would like to see that happen.
Hey, one last question, Lieutenant Governor Brown, if you have time for it. This is from Malloy, who wanted to know how you felt about the Maryland government's incentives for the film industry in Maryland, specifically the Netflix production of House of Cards. Did we go far enough? We come up short there.
And you know, that almost goes back to that previous question. Yeah. What's the appropriate level of tax credits? And I think this one ended up being around the $8 to $10 million range. And look, if tax credits incentivize an industry, whether it's the film, whether it's the investments at the Port of Baltimore that's creating thousands of jobs, if tax credits will incentivize industry to invest in jobs in Maryland, then we ought to give it serious consideration. So I do believe we have an opportunity to grow a film industry, certainly the support crews for that. So it's something I'll be watching closely. Let me finish with this. There's no government program or social program that can compete with a good family-supporting job.
All right. Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Dan.
Nice to have you back. Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, one of three candidates for governor in the Democratic primary next Tuesday, has been our guest here in this hour of the show. Thank you. And, folks, thanks for tuning in. Stay around for the second hour of our show coming up in just a few minutes after the news from NPR. We're going to take a break for lunch, brought to us by Breathe Bookstore Cafe right now. We'll have the news, and then Larry Hogan, Republican candidate, will be joining us.